go. So our guest for this session of the Futures Forum is Bruce Guthrie. Bruce grew up in Broadmeadows. Did you know Eddie?
I did.
There you go.
I did.
And worked as a public servant before starting as a copy boy on the Herald in 1972. He rose to the position of editor of the Herald Sun before being very publicly removed from office. And he moved on to become editor of The Age. Currently, he's the founding editor of the online newspaper New Daily, which began in 2013 and is financed by three of Australia's largest superannuation funds. He must be succeeding again, because just recently some of his media competitors have suggested that it's not appropriate for superannuation funds to be investing in new media and that they should immediately cease funding the New Daily. I believe the phrase was they shouldn't be throwing good money after bad.
I think that was the phrase.
So with a career spanning so many enterprises, Bruce is exceptionally well placed to talk about how the media landscape is changing and what role it could play in shaping Australia's future. So what do you have to tell us, Bruce?
Thanks, Charles. Firstly, I should apologise on behalf of Eric Beecher, who was originally, I think, scheduled to be here tonight. He's actually in New York. He had to go to New York on some philanthropic mission. But I've spent a large part of my career with people thinking I was Eric Beecher. We first worked together at the Melbourne Herald in 1987 when Rupert Murdoch bought it. And honestly, I spent a large part of my day fending off people asking me for pay rises because they thought I was Eric. And I'd say, look, I'm the deputy editor. The pay rises are in that corner over here. Just come and give me stories. So I communicated with him today and he again sends his regrets. Eric and I actually had a coffee before we left because I thought we should at least be somewhat on the same page when discussing the future of the media. And I think we agree that there's a revolution going on out there and it's being fought every day. And even for people like me who are in the front line, to some extent we're making it up every day. We're reinventing the business model and no one has got it right yet. But the reason that I think people should be taking it more seriously than perhaps many are is it's much more than about profits or moguls, you know, moving from this medium to this medium, or whether Gina Reinhart takes over Fairfax, or whether Rupert somehow, you know, gets control of 10. It's really about what sort of democracy we want. And I think it's why the future of the media is so much more important than the future of who owns it, who makes money out of it. And I'll talk about that over the next half hour or so. But I thought, even though we're talking here about the future, it would be worthwhile just recapping a little bit of history about how we came to this point in time. And I have a slightly different view than many. I wrote a book a couple of years ago called Man Bites Murdoch, which was ostensibly about a court case that I had against him, and it was more about 40 years of the print business and how it went up and then it came down, and we're very much on the downstroke. I think there were three strikes against the Australian news business in the last generation or so. The first one came in 1986, around Christmas 1986, when Rupert Murdoch was allowed to buy the Herald and Weekly Times. Now, we're all familiar with the Herald and Weekly Times in Melbourne. It dominated the corner of Exhibition and Flinders Street for many, many years. I started there as a copy boy, as Charles said, in 1972, left there in 1989. Around about Christmas in 86, Rupert walked into the building with his then CEO, Ken Cowley. He put a bid on the table at a board meeting at 9:30, and he pretty much owned the business by 4:30. And that was done because Paul Keating devised what he called his princes of print, queens of screen media policy. That was the way he dressed it up. But really what he was seeking to do was punish the Herald and Weekly Times, because the Herald and Weekly Times was seen as a Tory-backing media company that had given Keating and Hawke a lot of grief over their proposed assets test. And Keating went into the cabinet meeting and said, I want to make these changes. And in that cabinet meeting, he had lots of cuttings from the Melbourne Herald and the Sun on why it was important to change the ownership of the Herald Weekly Times. And the great beneficiary was Rupert Murdoch. I mean, Murdoch has been terrific at kind of working governments. He's not so much ideological, he just likes to get close to power. And he's also been very good at working what I call industrial intelligence. And he knew that if he waited any more than Christmas 86, the Herald and Weekly Times basically would become takeover proof sometime in 87, because they were planning a big takeover of a British media group. Many theorised it was the Telegraph in London. So Rupert suddenly had 75% of the Australian newspaper business. He had Channel 7, he had the West Australian. He was in time forced to divest of those. In fact, Robert Holmes Court grabbed both of them. But it meant that overnight we had this incredibly dominant proprietor, Rupert Murdoch, and he's been dominant ever since. The second strike was in 1989 when young Warwick Fairfax decided he would claim his birthright and made a disastrous takeover bid for Fairfax. And he did it, you know, at the height of the boom. Then there was the crash in 88, you know, and he was leveraged to Billy O, and he really couldn't service the debt. And so he was forced to basically put the whole thing into receivership in 91, 92. And what that meant was that Murdoch's only real competitor was suddenly wounded and robbed the company, I believe, of innovation. And so now we had a really dominant single proprietor in Rupert and a wounded second force in Fairfax. So they settled into a cosy duopoly, which I believe worked against the interests of readers and probably meant that they weren't as innovative as they should have been. So that when the internet, which was the third strike, came along in the mid-90s, they were pretty much asleep because they didn't need to innovate because they just had this money pouring in. Rupert and his newspapers really owned the bottom end of the market, the very lucrative tabloid market. He spent a lot of money on The Australian, but that was a loss maker, as it is now. That really gave him a seat at the table in Canberra, but he was making a fortune out of his tabloids. Still does, to a relative extent. The Age, meanwhile, had the broadsheet market. So they had the AB readers, they had the classifieds, and Rupert had the mass market. So everything was hunky-dory. So that when the internet came along in 95, 96, and started to impact on newsrooms, there was no real motivation to kind of tap into that. I was editing The Age at the time in 1996, and I had to make a really kind of impassioned argument to Fairfax manager in Sydney to just get into the space. At that point, The Age internet was was actually being run out of the research library by the librarian, who did it in her spare time. And she would go to the site and she'd pick stories that were interesting, but many of them were kind of libelous or defamatory, and so they would get up on the screen. Moira? How are you?
Good.
I'm just recapping the Age years.
Ah, the good old days.
The good old days. One thing, Moira, you were a columnist and all sorts of things.
Yep.
And I've mentioned Rupert and his takeover of the Herald Weekly Times, young Warwick's disastrous attempted takeover of Fairfax. And then the third strike was the internet. Not so much the internet itself, but the way Fairfax and to a lesser extent news were so late to the table. Because there was so much money pouring out of print that they thought, why move dollars out of print to a platform that may never make dollars? So they were asleep at the wheel when things like Seek.com came along and car sales came along. So I don't necessarily think the third strike was the arrival of the internet in a really kind of innovative company that could have been a great godsend. It may yet prove to be a godsend for journalism. But certainly The Age and to a lesser extent News were slow to move on those things. So they were to me the three strikes that really started the demise of newspapers. And I can remember when I took over at the Herald Sun in 2007, one of the first things that happened was that Rupert Murdoch flew all the editors to Monterey, California, because suddenly he had decided the internet, well, there might be some dough in this. After years of basically, you know, ignoring it. G'day, welcome. And I remember that I sat there in the audience as people like Mark Zuckerberg from Facebook sort of got up on stage, and Meg Whitman from eBay, and on about the third day of these sort of addresses, the organisers bust in a group of people from Berkeley, UC Berkeley, and they talked about the internet. And I remember Rupert said to them, he always sat in the front row, he took lots of notes, he'd duck out to try to buy the Wall Street Journal, then he'd come back and he'd say, how much would you be prepared to pay for the internet? And these were students, they were about 22, 23, and they said, we're never paying for the internet. I'm sorry, but you're talking to the wrong audience. We've grown up on free online, so if you think you're going to make a buck out of the internet, you've got another thing coming. And I think I could almost see the colour drain from his face, but I think he realised in 2007 that I better get serious about the internet. So that was really 10 years after the internet first surfaced in any meaningful way in Australia. And I think Fairfax were a bit asleep at the wheel as well. So it didn't really surprise me that, you know, journalism is suddenly kind of under attack, because the thing about the Age model was that it only ever really sold about 220,000 copies, but it had all this money pouring in through classifieds. I can tell you that as the editor of The Age in 95 to 97, one of the most soul-destroying things on a Friday night would be to go down to the loading bay. The paper would come off the press, because it was those wonderful days when papers were actually printed on site, and the building would shake and you could hear it, and you could go down and you'd go down on Friday night and people would be lined up around the block stretching into Spencer Street. The building's now been knocked over, I noticed, in the last month or so. And people would get the copy of The Age and they would throw away the editorial. And they would just walk away with the classified sections under their arms, because they wanted to be the first to buy the car, the house. And I thought, if anyone ever finds a better way to sell cars or houses, we're in big trouble. And of course they did. They found the internet. And The Age and The Herald Sun weren't really there for that when it happened. And all these new people came in. And the problem, and the reason why I think this discussion is important, is that the money that went into those classifieds, or went into those display ads, paid for the 300 journalists who sat up on the third floor, paid for the Ben Hillses of this world, and you know, the numerous, the David Wilsons and the great investigative reporters of The Age. There is an editor you could go and call them in and say, just go away and look at the Board of Works for a month. Something's not right there. And they might come back in a month and go, we didn't find anything. And you go, okay, fine. You need that ability to be able to sort of farm journalists out and give them the time to actually research and ask difficult questions. And because staffs have now been so cut back, you don't have that anymore. And so who's going to do the journalism? Who's going to do the journalism that I often say sheds light in dark places? And I think that's the real worry about where we're at in this point in time. When I edited The Age, we had 330 staff. When I edited The Herald Sun, 10 years later, we had about the same. I would say that the staffing levels are now about half that in each case. So that's had a profound effect. You know, it means that you don't have someone at the town hall. You maybe have one person at state parliament. You don't have foreign correspondents. You know, you don't have the investigative team of six. You maybe have two, if you're lucky. And the same goes on at the Herald Sun, not that they put necessarily the same resources into investigative journalism. Now, in any normal business, that kind of adjustment to cyclical and structural change would be seen as good business. And to some extent, it is good business. But for us, for a society, I think it's deeply troubling, because it means that the eyeballs that used to be there to keep an eye on politicians, to keep an eye on business, there's fewer and fewer of them. And I think that's why this kind of revolution, if you like, is profoundly worrying if we don't start to do things to impact on it, and I'll come to that in a second. Bill Keller, who's a former executive editor of the New York Times, if you ever get the chance, there's a fantastic documentary called Page One. It'll be in, I don't know, people still go to video stores, I'm not even sure, but you can download it on Apple. It's a documentary, 2-hour documentary, A Week in the Life of the New York Times. And Bill Keller, you know, is filmed walking out of the building one night after putting the paper to bed, and he says, news organisations that deploy resources to really gather information are essential to a functioning democracy. It just doesn't work if people don't know. And that was probably the one quote that resonated most with me out of that documentary, because I do think that if people are operating on 10, 20, 30, 40% of what's really going on, then it's really not an informed democracy. And I think we've reached that point. It means that we know a lot less about what's really going on, and democracy is diminished. If you think about it, the major royal commissions, even the ones that are going on now, whether it's into paedophile priests, you know, the Building Royal Commission, the ICAC inquiries in Sydney, all stemmed from newspaper reporting in the first instance. It's been a great sort of generator of public discourse, public investigation, and my fear is that there's going to be less and less of that. Like Kate McClymont is a brilliant reporter on the Sydney Morning Herald and almost single-handedly brought about the Eddie Obeid ICAC inquiry. I worry in another 5 years whether we can afford people like Kate McClymont, whether the Sydney Morning Herald will just go, well, that's great, but it doesn't give us sales and it doesn't give us clicks. We need to now be driven entirely by those things that drive audience. And that's the next thing that's happening with online, and it's what I call the race to the bottom. And when I think about this race to the bottom, I recall the great British newspaper Lord Beaverbrook, who really kick-started the London Red Tops in the early 20th century. And he used to sit his editors down and he would say, give the readers what they want. Now, if you're told that, it's pretty easy, because I've always said that broadsheet newspapers make people think, tabloid newspapers make people feel. So if I'm editing The Age, if I'm editing even The Australian, you want people to think about issues in a particular way. The Australian wants them to think in a conservative way, The Age might want them to think in a centre-left way, The Guardian might want them to think in a left way, so on and so forth. But they're really papers for people who think, and you want to make them think. Tabloids, you really want to make people feel. It was quite interesting for me to go from editing The Age to editing The Herald Sun. Quite often I would be dealing with the same stories, but with The Age I would be packaging in a way that really made people think about, why is this story relevant to me? And in The Herald Sun I was always trying to find the emotional centre of the story, and so I would lead on that. And, you know, tabloids work positive and negative emotions. You know, anger, greed, jealousy, all the way up to triumph and success. And to me, it was never quite clear which sold more papers. Sometimes you went downbeat and it walked off the shelves, and sometimes you went upbeat, no one bought it, and then the reverse would happen. The Age was really about the same people buying the paper every day, because it was much more a subscription model, and you had the luxury of kind of reporting on things that they needed to know, and perhaps even should know, rather than they wanted to know. So the Herald Sun and all those tabloids are about a want, and The Age is about a need, in my view. But the internet is changing that, because the internet is about clicks. And if a story doesn't get traffic, it drops off. So in a sense, I talk to Age executives now and they say, oh, we'll follow the audience where the audience takes us. And to me, that's the same thing that Lord Beaverbrook said 100 years ago, give them what they want. That's not the way The Age used to operate. The Age used to operate by saying, These are the agendas that we think are important to our readers and to this state, to this city, to this country, and we're going to report the hell out of them. And we're going to stay within these pretty defined parameters, and we're going to stick with it. But the Age may still cling to that a little bit in print, but online, it's really chasing traffic. So, in preparation for today, I was sitting in my office yesterday at 10:40, and so I thought I'll check the top five websites in Australia right now. And the top five websites had the following stories. 10:40 yesterday morning. The Sydney Morning Herald was leading with the news that Senator Nova Peris had once called Cathy Freeman dumb in a private email. That was the Sydney Morning Herald's lead at 20 minutes to 11 yesterday morning. Okay? The Sydney Morning Herald is the biggest website in Australia. The second biggest is news.com. So I went there. They had the same story. So then I went to the third website, 9MSN. They had the Nova Peris story, but fighting for prominence was a second story, and I'm not making this up. Molly burnt his penis with Vicks. And it was a story that I didn't read the story. I wanted to read the story, I didn't read the story. Molly Meldrum had somehow burnt his penis with Vicks. That was the third biggest website in Australia. The fourth biggest site was the ABC. They led with Nova Peris, but they led with her denials. So we'll cut them, that one. And then the fifth one was the new one, the Daily Mail. They broke with everyone else and they led with the exploding NASA rocket. But their close second story was Bruce Jenner has celebrated his 65th birthday by getting a pink manicure. So those were the top five online news sites in Australia at 20 minutes to 11 yesterday. Just a random time. I literally just clicked on. I thought, I'll go on now and see what they're doing. And it convinced me that what we've got here is a race to the bottom. Because if you put up a story and it doesn't get traffic, the story falls away. It just goes. We now have access to things called analytics. We have things called Chartbeat, which will show you how far people read stories until they give up. And if you're not careful, this thing winks at you all day and says, they have stopped reading the story about Nova Peris. They've started reading the story about Molly Meldrum. Lesser sites will say, let's get rid of Nova, let's put Molly up there. It's become that, you know, these things have moved around like jigsaw pieces. So what you end up with there is you don't commission stories unless they're going to get traffic, which is a long way from Ben Hills or David Wilson being told, go away for a month and look, take a look at the Border Works, or Kate McClymont going away and looking at Eddie Obeid. It's almost 180 degrees opposed to that sort of view. And my fear is that when print goes completely, and I think The Age will probably move to 2 or 3 day a week publishing, possibly within 12 to 24 months, that'll become even more pronounced. So the problem is that although eyeballs have moved to the internet, we've become captive to these clicks. And so the journalism will become more populist, more tabloid, more driven by emotion, less driven by thought. That's the future, folks, if we're not careful. And it's going to get worse before it gets better, because one of the biggest changes between the internet and newspapers is on newspapers, the ad inventory was very small. Because you think about it, most cities only had one newspaper. Melbourne was fortunate to have two. Sydney had two. But that meant there were only so many ad slots every day. If you wanted to have a full-page ad in a newspaper in Melbourne or Sydney, there are only so many slots. So that gave the whip hand to newspaper proprietors. The internet is very different. The inventory is huge. It's almost endless. You don't have to worry about pagination. There are more and more sites springing up every day. And the advertisers can actually track the effectiveness of an ad. When I was at The Age, we might sell a full-page ad for $25,000, more in the Saturday paper. And that was sold on the back of what was called Morgan Research. And the Morgan Research was an estimate of readership. So Morgan might estimate that every Saturday, 1 million people read The Age. So we sold our ads on the basis of 1 million readers will look at your ad, even though we probably knew that maybe one-tenth of them did. But there was really no way of tracking how many read the ad. Now there is. So instead of advertisers saying, here's $50,000, I'll buy an ad in the Saturday Age, what they now do is say, here's my ad, I will pay you $10 for every pair of eyeballs that looks at it. And I'll know how many eyeballs look at it because I've got Google Analytics. So the next day, they'll look at the page impressions and they'll say, 500 people looked at my ad, so I'll pay you $5,000, which is a long way short of $50,000. So the power has shifted to advertisers and to some extent the readers. And the gatekeepers, who used to be editors and proprietors, are watching their power ebb away, and they're willingly giving it to the readers and the users because they need the clicks. You know, it reminds me of an old joke that Woody Allen started, the opening line of Annie Hall, and Woody Allen says he went to a shrink and he said, doctor, you've got to help me, my brother thinks he's a chicken. And the doctor said, well, what's the problem with that? You just sit him down and calmly explain that he's not a chicken. And Woody Allen says, yeah, I would, but I really, really need the eggs. And the problem is, we might want to sit there and go, we want to raise the standards of journalism, but we need the eggs, we need the clicks. So there's a kind of a bit of a storm coming here that journalism is going to get more and more frivolous before it gets any better. And so what are we going to do about it? And I might just say, it's worth running through the 10 sites just before we get onto that. And this will intrigue you. Number one, City Morning Herald. Number two, News.com. Number three, 9MSN.com. Number four, ABC. Number five, Daily Mail. Number six, The Age. Number seven, The Guardian. Number eight, Yahoo 7. Number nine, The Herald Sun. Number 10, BBC. What's really interesting about that is that seven of them are free. The ones that are trying to establish paywalls, the SMH, the Herald Sun, are struggling on that basis. And three of them are British imports, the Daily Mail, the Guardian, and the BBC. I was on Q&A. I made one appearance on Q&A about a year ago. It was behind the guy who fainted on stage. I think it was about the second most disastrous appearance ever on Q&A. Because someone forgot to give me the topics. And I didn't realise you got the topics ahead of time. And so I turned up and I said, so what are we talking about? And they said, you didn't get the topics on Friday? And I said, you mean all these, the other, they've had 3 days to prepare? So I just went in cold and someone asked me, what is the future? We're getting to the future, Charles. My hope is that we go from a barren landscape, I said on Q&A, where we have these two monoliths, Fairfax and an even bigger one called News, to a teeming rainforest. I mean, that's got to be the hope, that as the barriers to entry come down, and they've come down, you no longer need a printing press, you no longer need ink, you no longer need news agents. You don't have to have a distribution network, you don't need trucks. So anyone really with an idea and a keyboard can be a publisher. And so my hope is that we go from this kind of this landscape that's dominated by corporate journalism driven by big, big profit margins. When I ran The Age, we made 30 cents in the dollar profit. It's probably down to around 10 cents now, but it's still a good business. Supermarkets run on about 2 or 3 cents in the dollar. So it's still a good business for all the doomsayers. But what worries me is I look at that. I launched The Age website in 96. Here we are 18 years later. We're still dominated by the big legacy mastheads. You know, there's been a couple, like Crikey's trying its best, but it's small. I don't see too many edging towards the top 10. And that worries me. It says that, in a sense, the ownership of newspapers has progressed online, and we've still got too few voices. We're still dominated by Fairfax and News Limited, and we've had these three entrants from Britain. Where are the Australian sites? Where are the ones punching above their weight? And I think that's what we've got to hope for. And so I think that the challenge for politicians, and it's a big challenge, particularly when they're being serviced, if you like, by Rupert Murdoch, and they're being protected, as I think, you know, at the moment Tony Abbott's enjoying a good ride with Rupert. Rupert's enjoying, it's kind of a symbiotic relationship. They're both benefiting. Two quite different organisms, but they're benefiting. I think we're fast approaching the time where we have to start egging something. We have to put egg, you know, into this mix, because if it's just left to the market, journalism, I fear, is going to deteriorate further and further. It'll be a race to the bottom. There'll be no one keeping the bastards honest. So, what do we do? One option is the ABC. Now, my personal view is the ABC does a great job, but I'd like them to put more money into journalism, particularly at this time. While journalism is diminishing in this country, I think there's a real opportunity for the ABC to spend not less but more on journalism, more Four Corners, more 7:30, more Late Line, you know, perhaps new shows, because that's where the need is. I don't really want to watch, you know, Louis Theroux again, you know, for the 13th time, going to Los Angeles and exploring the pornography industry or something. Much as that's entertaining, I just think the ABC money could be better deployed. And maybe one thought, and, you know, we toss this open for discussion later, but one thought is, should the government mandate that a certain part of the budget should be spent on journalism? And maybe in this climate of the ABC saying, please don't cut our budgets, Mark Scott says, give me an extra $50 million and I will put that into journalism. I'll lock it in and we'll have, you know, better journalism in this country. Now, some might say that governments don't want better journalism, but I think we as a public should demand it. So the ABC is an option. The second one, which could be done almost with the stroke of a pen. Week in, week out, particularly now, governments of all persuasions spend tens of millions of dollars on advertising. Tens of millions. Whether it's, and a lot of it goes to News Limited, a lot of it goes to Fairfax. If they diverted 5% of that, what I would estimate would be a $100 million plus budget a year, to startups, to independent publishers, and just said, for the next 5 years, 5% of our expenditure on all forms of digital media is going to go to sites that are less than 5 years old. That would probably be the difference between demise and survival for many sites. It would be very, very easy, and I think it would be politically popular. Similarly, I would love to see governments encourage publishers through grants, through, you know, favourable taxation regimes, seed capital, to get into the business of online publishing. One of the interesting things about online publishing is that although what I call legacy media is based in Sydney, you know, the head office of News Limited is in Sydney, the head office of Fairfax is in Sydney, a lot of online publications are in Melbourne. You know, whether it's private media, which is, you know, Crikey, whether it's the New Daily, whether it's, you know, carsales.com. There's a lot of, and I could see an opportunity for the next government, be it Labor or Liberal, to really run with that. And I know that there were discussions with John Brumby in the last weeks of his government to begin to foster that. And I'd love to see someone pick up and run with it. But it could also be done by a national government just encouraging publishers into this space on the basis that we need an informed democracy. I mean, on that, I mean, the French government, as some may know, actively encourages people to get involved in journalism. They give special postal rates when periodicals are mailed around the country. And anyone under 18 who wants to take a subscription to a newspaper, whether it be online or print, gets it for free. It's paid for by the government. And this is an attempt by the French government to protect an important industry and educate, you know, the populace. So again, the democracy is better informed. I mean, there's a whole debate about whether government should have any role in that, but I, for one, would love to. I think it would be a terrific innovation. Another possibility is to establish a trust. Well, the Guardian has operated on this basis for half a century now. You know, it loses a lot of money. I think it lost £40 million last year. But it recently sold Auto Trader, which it owned in Britain, and it's now got enough money in the bank that if they never sold another ad, they would be able to fund those losses. And they are able to kind of remain above the intrusions of government. They're not really dictated to by the normal things that drive companies, profit motive. And they've done a fantastic job of moving their business online. So maybe there's space, you know, in creating some sort of trust. I mean, I think you could do a very, very good website on $7 to $10 million a year. That would probably employ 50 to 60 journalists. You could have a fairly strict agenda. These are the areas we want to cover. And in time, you'd get an advertising support. Now, if there was some sort of trust that could be established, maybe with input from some of the philanthropic organisations, that could be another way to kind of improve the discourse. I think one of the really important things to understand is, and I come across this a lot on the New Daily, because as you made mention of, Charles, when the idea of industry superfunds getting into media first came up, this was seen as, you know, horrendous, principally by The Australian and principally by Judith Sloan, who thought it was a misuse of superannuation funds. But what I would argue she doesn't understand is that in journalism, not only is the business model changing, but the ownership model's changing for the reasons we've discussed. You don't need a printing press, you don't need trucks, you don't need ink. So it's much easier to create a media business. So Jeff Bezos, you know, who owns Amazon.com, now owns the Washington Post and is beginning to rebuild that masthead. And I get quite short-tempered with people going, oh, there's no place for industry superfunds in journalism. Well, I go, well, hang on. Why is it that not-for-profit superannuation funds can build dams, you know, apartment blocks, roads, but they can't be part of the national conversation? I find it extraordinary that people would argue that. I actually think there's almost a responsibility in this environment, as journalism is diminishing, to be part of that conversation, to try to inform democracy in a better way. But I've been struck at just, you know, the vehemence that of some of the criticism of us. And of course they say, oh, well, you're just a mouthpiece for the industry superfunds. In fact, before I agreed to be part of it, I wrote an editorial charter, which sets out exactly what we'll cover, how we'll cover sensitive areas like industrial relations. And it was agreed to in a second by, you know, I remember talking to Australian Super, which is an interesting experience because on one side of the board table you have people in, you know, jeans, T-shirts and hard hats, and on the other side you've got people in three-piece suits. And I presented the charter and it went through unchanged. And our goal is in time, we're in startup mode now, is to create a site that presents news in hopefully a balanced, fair, unvarnished fashion on the issues of the day. And I can't for the life of me understand why that so distresses commentators such as Judith Sloan and papers like The Australian, when really they should be welcoming more journalism, more competitors. But the reality is that they're not. And it's particularly disturbing because it comes at a time when the big proprietors are shedding a lot of journalists. A lot of journalists. I wrote a column for The Age a couple of years ago, and it said this, that the sad reality is that over the next couple of years, a great many journalists are going to be offloaded by Australia's major media companies. There could be 400 of them gone from Fairfax, and I wouldn't mind betting it'll be about the same at News, and that's been proven true over the intervening 2 years. Each of those journalists is capable of becoming a publisher. These days, all that's needed is a good idea, a keyboard and an internet connection. Surely it's time to encourage more entrants into that space. Governments have a role to play here by offering tax breaks, seed capital, whatever it takes to get a good idea to market and turn sack journalists into online entrepreneurs and publishers, reporting the hell out of their chosen fields. Some will devote themselves to covering a single community, others a specific beat, whether it be crime, politics or health. If enough of them make a go of it, we'll start to shed light again in the places that might otherwise grow dark in the years to come. Along the way, we'll pick up more voices so that journalism isn't singing from the same song sheet every day. And democracy deserves it. In fact, it demands it. And I feel that more than ever. I feel that unless people like us start to say, hang on, I think I'm finding out less and less every day, because the same journalists are writing for six papers in one day. The government, you turn on the nightly news and there's a recorded video message from the Prime Minister. It's not a doorstop, it's not a press conference, it's something that he's taped in his own office, put out there, and it's making the nightly news most nights with just a small watermark saying government message. And I'm thinking, what the hell is going on here? So I think that we need to demand more of our existing media. We need to pressure governments to say this stuff matters to us. And if we don't, I think the future of journalism is bleak. It'll be a race to the bottom. And I fear that race is already underway. Look, I'll end it there, but obviously happy to discuss, take questions, and happy to get a conversation going.